You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
Band. I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right, 'cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, 'cause they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America, the best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and children of all ages to the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, brought to you exclusively every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Central Time on RadioAryan.com and then repeated throughout the week on YouTube. On this week's episode of the Roper Report, I'm going to be talking to you about telogeny. I promised last week I'm going to deliver this week. I'm also going to discuss how egalitarianism eats itself and bring you reports from yesterday's Shield Wall Network meeting in Central Arkansas. A lot of surprises happened there that even I had not anticipated. And I think that they will be pleasant surprises for you to hear about as well. But first, let's get started talking about this time of year. This is the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, for the very first week of December. And in addition to being the beginning of winter and Christmas season, it's also the beginning of flu season. You can probably hear it in my voice that right now I'm a little short of breath because I am fighting a chest cold and I think I have a fever, but neither rain nor sleet nor snow nor chest congestion nor a fever will stop the Roper Report, right? We're going to bring it to you hard and fast right now, despite our illness and despite the time of year when everyone is more busy than ever. I hope that you'll take the next hour to listen to our news and political opinions. Now, in addition to this being cold and flu season and Christmas shopping season, it is the beginning of the time when we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ. And as I was discussing with my family during our home church just about an hour ago, we don't know, as Christians, exactly when Jesus was born. According to the description in Luke, probably since the shepherds were in the fields watching their flocks by night, it was around harvest time rather than in the dead of winter, because they had not yet brought in all of their sheep to be close to their houses so they could keep them warm. They were still getting some grazing off the grass because, you know, even in the Middle East, there are seasons. And in December, it's not really grazing season. Also, the taxation time when Joseph and Mary and all the descendants of King David went to Bethlehem happened after the harvest time, when people got paid and got the most money they're going to have all year after the harvest. That was when they were taxed, because obviously the government was smart enough, just like they are now, to try to take money from people when people had the money. So we can probably say that the actual nativity, the actual birth of Christ, was in the late fall around harvest, but throughout the centuries, with changes in calendars, we have grown accustomed to the tradition of celebrating it on December the 25th. And I do understand the controversies and the legends about how it is a co-option or an adoption of perhaps pagan or heathen holidays, midwinter festivals, and Yule. But regardless, as I've said before about dietary laws and which translation to use and what name to call God, I believe that my God, having created everything and knowing everything, also knows when I'm talking to Him, and He knows what my heart is, and He knows what my intentions are. And so he also knows that when I celebrate the birth of his son, Jesus Christ, I'm trying to get it right. I may not have all the details correct, but my heart's in the right place. And I think that's the most important thing. I believe that God also understands that we are, because we're his creations, you know, imperfect, and we dissent, and we sometimes go astray, but we do our best. We do our best. And so it is the Christmas season, and I hope that all of you are spending time with your families and making that really count, because ultimately, it's not about presents. It's not about Santa Claus or what's under the tree. It's not about watching football or how much you can eat. It's really about the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and secondarily, enjoying those people that we love and who love us, because time does move fast. Only a couple of years ago, I was able to enjoy Christmas with my father and with my grandmother, and both of them have now passed on. I no longer have that luxury. So enjoy your family. Try to keep the peace if you can during the holidays, even if people are normies, because the time will come when those people that perhaps you now take for granted are no longer available, when they have passed on and answered that question that we all face into the next life. We hope that you will enjoy your family this holiday season. And so from our family to yours, Merry Christmas. We've been extremely busy. Over the last several days, we've actually traveled over 100 miles in every single conceivable direction, and that's really not going to stop anytime soon. We've gone to country music concerts and potlucks, and we've gone to Arkansas Symphony Orchestra concerts, and we've gone to meetings in every cardinal direction. And yesterday, we went south to Central Arkansas, where we held the Shieldwall Network meeting there, and I'll be giving you some details in just a few minutes about that. Tomorrow, I'll be wrapped up all day with two different video camera crews. I'm working on documentaries from early morning until at least late evening. And then Wednesday, before this actual broadcast is delivered on RadioArian.com, I'll be doing a live radio program, a podcast of the Daily Traditionalist Show, co-hosting with Matt Heimbach. And I hope that by the time that you hear this, you've had the opportunity to hear that one as well. And then next Saturday, we've been invited to attend the Knights Party, Christmas Party, in Harrison, Arkansas, with Pastor Thomas Robb and his family and his congregation and church, as well as members of the organization, the Knights Party. We look forward to that fellowship and camaraderie as well. But before we actually move into what happened yesterday at our own meeting, I want to answer a question that I began to talk about last week before we ran out of time. And I've written a couple of articles about this subject on The Rope Report, which you can access at whitenationalist.com or through theropereportsite.wordpress.com or just by Googling Billy Roper. And that's the subject of telogeny. And it's a controversial subject. It's really a theory, but it's a theory that I believe has a lot of scientific merit. And biology does not lie. Biology, as we know when it comes to race and genes, does not change to suit politically correct whims. Whatever winds may change in anthropology after the Boas school has taken over, basic human genetics and animal genetics has remained the same. So let's talk a little bit about telogeny. What is telogeny? Well, telogeny is basically the idea that a female's prior offspring can affect not only her genetic makeup, but the genetic makeup of her future offspring. And that happens because the male sperm donor's DNA is literally absorbed by the female and becomes part of hers, literally changing her genetic makeup and the genetic makeup of any offspring. Also, because she shares fetal blood with the embryo, with the baby, while she's carrying it in her womb. She is sharing the genetic code, the genetic DNA of that infant. And so we have seen physical traits passed on not only from generation to generation, but laterally, vertically, within a generation. So let's talk about how telogeny happens. Now, obviously, we know in the animal world, it's pretty accepted. For some reason, a lot of people have problems understanding or dealing with the harsh truth that, in general, what is true for the animal world is also true for us. And telogeny is one of those cases. So, dog breeders and horse breeders know that telogeny is a thing, and it's real. And so do cattle breeders. You know, if a stump, or if a low-quality bull gets in with a cattleman's herd and gets to his heifers, to his female cows, before he's able to breed her with a high-quality bull, for which they often pay really high, exorbitant stud fees, then that rancher will probably kill the heifer and go ahead and slaughter her because she's ruined, because her future offspring will carry the traits of that scrub bull, that low-quality male, even if she is later mated with a higher-quality bull. Now, that is true for cattle and for horses and for other mammals, and it's also true for us Homo sapiens, sapiens. Now, how does that really work? Well, it's because the mitochondria in the DNA of the human genome actually has 25,000 genes packaged in every human cell. There are 23 pairs of those chromosomes, and the chromosome is made up of those genes. So we have something called epigenetics, and epigenetics is influence on an offspring or an individual outside of actual DNA inheritance. So epigenetics can include environment, even things like temperature and radiation and food and drugs and nutrients that produce immediate effects that can be imprinted long-term on the mom's DNA. So the genes consist of DNA, which is made up of those four chemical letters, and that's the code that defines us, that tells every cell what to be and what kind of cell to be and what kind of that kind to be. So a mutation in that code can produce genotypes or rare genetic disorders, good things or bad things, and that's actually how natural selection happens, through recessive genes being preserved and becoming dominant, or through hybridization, through breeding back to the less evolved primitive mean, them being subsumed back into the morass, blue eyes versus brown eyes. So basically, in telogeny, male DNA from former sexual partners is often transmitted, let's keep this family friendly, right, via transference to a woman who bears children by that male after she gets pregnant, and that ends up with not only her immature eggs through her bloodstream sharing that fetal blood with the baby, but in her brain as well. So scientific studies indicate that that also affects a woman's chances of acquiring Alzheimer's disease. So here's what's interesting. It's not just semen which carries DNA or can transfer it. I'm going to repeat that. Not just semen. You can get a transference of DNA through blood. Every time that you actually get a transfusion, you're bringing someone else's DNA into your body and absorbing part of that genetic code, and it's becoming part of your own. So that might be a consideration for those who would otherwise have a transfusion. I would recommend, if you have the opportunity to make donations yourself and put back your own store of blood at your local hospital, because actually, if you get a blood transfusion, you are actually changing your own genetic code through transference. Now, if you're in a state of trauma, obviously, and as that's often the case when you have a blood transfusion, you will absorb the DNA of those blood donors, and not only can those genes be passed on to offspring once they're absorbed, but they also can and do show up in later DNA tests, skewing the results. So if you've ever had an organ transplant or a blood transfusion, then that will skew your own DNA test, as well as the genetic makeup of your children. So previously, I wrote about on the Rope Report how male sperm can change the DNA of an immature egg in a female without fertilizing. So I encourage you to go back to the roperreportsite.wordpress.com and just scroll down until you see telogeny. One of those articles actually will be the third one that I've written that will discuss how that happens. Now, there's an expert researcher named Dr. Angela Crean, who's led studies about telogeny, and she said, and I quote, "Our discovery complicates our entire view of how variation is transmitted across generations, but also it opens up exciting new possibilities and avenues of research." And they thought that Dr. Joseph Mengele was off, right? So just as we think we have things figured out, she said, "Nature throws us a curveball and shows us how much we still have to learn." And she continues to say, "The evidence now shows that female animals can incorporate sperm DNA from her prior sex partners." Think about that, folks. And think about that when there's a thought involved, like a THOT involved. That foreign DNA winds up in future children after the woman successfully reproduces with a completely different male. And so, in the human world, what that means for us is that the children a man has with a promiscuous woman could possess genes from previous sexual partners that he has never seen or met. So, there are, of course, you know, in culture, existing sociological studies and experiences that show a marriage is far more likely to fail when a woman has had more than two prior sexual partners. I won't cite those stats, but they're in the article that you can find on my website. But now, there's renewed support in the scientific community as well for what was called the once questionable field of telogeny. And telogeny is now showing that there are also genetic reasons not to start a family with a promiscuous woman if you want your kids to have your genes, which most guys do. So children that you have with that promiscuous woman, you know, may have their gene pool polluted, if you will, by her random affairs and one-night stands. So it's already been observed that the human female body, I guess, acts as a sponge for foreign DNA that's placed within it, no pun intended. So it's possible, you know, that microchimerism in the brain, which is where a foreign genetic code, another person's DNA, is absorbed into tissue, that microchimerism in the brain is able to differentiate into various mature phenotypes, different ethnic or racial types, or undergoes fusion with pre-existing cells and then, you know, acquires that new phenotype. And that's suggested by marine and human studies in which bone marrow-derived cells for those transplants were circulated to the brain through the bloodstream and generated neuronal cells by differentiation, by really one generation evolution, are fused with pre-existing neurons. So, you know, when we talk about these relationships between microchimerism and telogeny and health versus disease, it really requires a lot of further study, but no longer can liberals say that it does not matter. I think that genetics and DNA is really fascinating, and we need to not shy away from the sometimes uncomfortable conclusions that reality and biology and science will lead us to, even if it may be personally awkward and hurtful for some of us. But the first fact we need to recognize is that a woman can absorb enough DNA during her lifetime that it changes her phenotype, her appearance, and really her overall health state. So, the second implication stems from the fact that it's scientifically conclusive. We know for a fact that single mothers have DNA of their bastard children, if you will, right? Their children born out of wedlock, residing permanently within their bodies. So any man who reproduces with a single mom will have a child that contains DNA from the bastard spawn, which of course includes DNA from the absentee father. Now that means that the guys can be genetically cucked without being traditionally cucked. And, you know, having a baby with a single mom, honestly, is essentially giving the father of her first child a bonus prize in the game of evolution. So, microchimerism. It's also been noted in dogs, where older siblings in dogs pass on their DNA to younger siblings. Now, we think about medieval times and the Renaissance and how nobility and kings had their arranged marriages and how they wanted to have a virgin bride for a reason. It's really a lot easier to understand now. Our ancestors were not as stupid as we thought. So that suggests that firstborns possess the highest genetic purity. And that's a suspicion or an instinctual feeling that was held by the royalty of old, too, because the firstborn were the inheritors, right? Not only that, but, you know, female dogs incorporated the Y chromosome material from her male children. So the mother dog actually essentially becomes more masculine by having sons. There's no reason to believe that what's true for canines is not true for human beings. So those researchers found cells with those Y chromosomes in the mom after those births, and that meant that, you know, the mom had male cells present in her female body. She wasn't transsexual, right? She was just absorbing the male DNA by having male partners and male children. So the researchers also found genetically similar male cells in the mom's female puppies. Talking about the dog still from that study from a later litter. So those puppies were newborn and had never been pregnant. So that really strongly suggests that they acquired the cells that were left behind by their older brothers while they were still in the womb. I know that gets kind of complicated, but think about puppies. Think about people. The biological processes are the same. If a woman absorbs Y chromosome genes from male sperm via casual sex, then that would easily explain why women with high notch counts, if you know what I mean, women who are promiscuous, well, they exhibit, in my experience, more masculine traits. And that's something that, you know, anybody, any guy that's had a lot of experience with women could anecdotally confirm for sure. So a promiscuous girl becomes more masculine because, you know, over time, various masculine genes literally are being inserted into her genome and affecting her phenotype. So there are a lot of older ideas, you know, about telogeny dating back over a century, and they don't really seem so bizarre or ridiculous now. There was a French biologist and philosopher named Félix Lédantec who wrote a book in 1899, just about the turn of the century, called Individual Evolution, Heredity, and Neo-Darwinist. Once again, that's Individual Evolution, Heredity, and Neo-Darwinist. And he mentioned several facts that demonstrate telogeny happening. Some liberals since then tried to call it pseudoscience, just like they call every biology and racial fact today that's politically incorrect pseudoscience, even though we know that what's true for the dogs and the geese and the chimpanzees is also true for us. And what the liberals call pseudoscience just means science and facts that they hate. Lédantec, in that book, The Individual Evolution, Heredity, and Neo-Darwinism, 1899, wrote that a lot of farmers had actually observed that pigs who copulated, who bred with a boar, actually saw that the pigs, you know, the babies absolutely resembled the father in color, but when the same pigs bred with another boar, that some of the pigs of the second feral, like a litter, still resembled the color of the male pig that the swine had copulated with, bred with first. That's exactly what we were saying, that those genes are passed on. And so, you know, we also have Lord Morton, who first did scientific experiments on telogeny by interbreeding a mare and a zebra and got a hybrid of that horse and zebra. And then he interbred the same mare with a regular horse. And as a result, the colt that was born had lines resembling those of a zebra, the second one. So telogeny and microchimerism is on the leading edge right now of genetic research. It's been opened up once again by reality and scientists being courageous enough to admit that the liberals and their idea that race is a social construct and that genes don't count for anything are incorrect. And even worse, they know better and they're lying. Now, that's also included epigenetics, which is, you know, the switching off and the on of certain genetic codes and certain genes due to those environmental cues I talked about just a minute ago. So epigenetics has raised those questions about evolutionary theory because it shows genetic adaptation can occur within individual organisms in one generation without the need for natural selection. How cool is that, right? It's pretty interesting to me. So that new research is revealing how little we actually know about how the human genome works and how much research needs to still happen. And it suggests that there's a more complex picture for selection than we've imagined. So, you know, that sociological research was the first to show that marrying women with a robust sexual history, so to speak, increase the likelihood of a failed marriage. And now genetic research has more evidence to show that those kind of women will usually give birth to children that, to a degree we don't yet understand, are not entirely of that father's. So because that's a new field of research and it's politically incorrect, yeah, very politically incorrect, it does paint a strongly negative consequence for women who are leading a strong and independent, single, promiscuous lifestyle. So, you know, we're really unlikely to ever see liberal universities approve much in the way of further research in that area, so we have to wait. And then once we have a white ethnostate, and part of the government-sponsored eugenics program can also reap a lot of new knowledge and understanding of that aspect of human biology. So if you're also interested in telogeny and epigenetics, then I encourage you to email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com, especially if you've come across any scientific research in the area that is ongoing or new. I'd be happy to discuss it with you further, because we're pushing the envelope now on understanding what makes us who we are. And that is, what is telogeny? Now, when we're talking about genetics, there's something else you need to understand about egalitarianism and how it, through assimilation, has eaten itself. The idea that everyone is equal or should be equal, or that the outcome should be equal, has been turned on its creators and is now pushing them towards assimilation and really genetic extinction. And here's how that happened. In the bloody aftermath of the French Revolution, what happened was that most of the revolutionaries, the Jacobins, who had radicalized the population against the nobility and the royalty and chopped off their heads, they were in turn, you know, kind of swept away by the tide, rushing forth from the guillotine's blade. And that wasn't a fluke, because all revolutionary movements tend to eat their own. And that's true. Think about George Lincoln Rockwell. It's also true if think about Malcolm X. Egalitarianism also eats its own. Now, egalitarianism, you know, is a promotion of the idea that we want to level all environmental influences. So thinking about what we know about genetics and what we inherit and what we actually absorb from our environment, we get into the whole nature versus nurture debate once again, try to determine what percentage of our psychological traits and our intellectual traits and our physical traits, our racial traits actually come from our genes, and what kind of inheritance or adaptations come directly from our environment that are not heritable. So, thinking about what we just said about epigenetics and telogeny, we can say that, according to most scientific research, when it comes to intellectual and psychological inheritance, most of the studies indicate that about 50% or about half of our traits make us smart or dumb, give us interest or lack of interest, are inherited. About 50%, about half. And that's been pretty consistent over the last generation. So liberals might look at that and say, well, that means that half of who you are isn't affected by your ancestry, by your genes. And so we's all bees equals if we had equal education and access to good nutrition. That's why they push egalitarianism. Now, here's the irony. Here is how their chutzpah gets them hoisted on their own petard, like Shakespeare wrote. So egalitarianism promotes the leveling of all environmental influences, like I said, and just as Karl Marx, another Jew, intended, instead of creating merely an equality of opportunity, the goal of liberal democracy is an equality of outcome, and that means that nobody can have an advantage over anybody else. We all have to be equal in our opportunities and our outcome, so you can't inherit wealth. They'll give you estate taxes to take that away. All the schools have to be equal in enrollment and in funding and in quality of curriculum. That's why you have still, you know, 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education, you still have desegregation busing going on. You have to have equal nutrition and emotional support. It all has to be, you know, at least comparable for all. And that's why you have government dietitians and lunchrooms and counselors. And in short, you know, egalitarianism in the whole nature versus nurture debate, where it's generally accepted that, like I said, about half of intelligence is inherited. And you can just Google that and find all those research projects that will support me on that half. But egalitarianism eliminates the other half that is not inherited, right? It inherits 50% and eliminates the other 50%, the environmental differences which affect IQ. Because egalitarianism tries to remove those environmental differences and make us all have the same experiences, the only differences left are those that we inherit. And that means, ipso facto, that egalitarianism increases the importance of inherited intelligence and inherited intellectual differences when we're measuring human intelligent differences. Does that make sense to you? Right? So, sure, if you eliminate or reduce the environmental factors which influence intelligence through attempting to supply both an equal opportunity and environmental outcome to everybody from their birth, and the hereditary factors which come into play before birth are going to be even more important then, relatively, aren't they? So, of course, there's that, you know, awkward 9 months time we talked about before with telogeny and epigenetics in the womb itself, in between conception and birth, when the fetus is influenced by those telogenetic reception of DNA from maybe previous siblings or previous sex partners of their moms, as well as what she eats and drinks and breathes and feels and the hormones and all the other chemicals in her body that she ingests and reproduces. But we already know that while IQ does change over time, as we get older, counterintuitively, what you might guess is wrong. The hereditable contributions don't decrease as we get older, as we might think. They actually increase percentage-wise, because as we age, we develop a lot more independent thinking skills that, you know, they free us from peer pressure or from all the environmental strictures that shape our intellect when we're young. So we become more of ourselves as we get older, and we become more serious and disciplined. We're able to feed ourselves and look after our own health. We're less subject to our environments and to other people, and so are our brains, our intelligence, and that shows up when its quotient is measured. So as we get older, our IQ actually reverts back to its inherited level. And as we get older, the influence of environment and nurture becomes smaller and smaller. So some far-thinking leftists, those idealistic ones who are social engineers, are beginning to get that. They're seeing the writing on the wall. And that's why they're now focusing on the evils of white privilege. You know, it's not something you do. It's something you were born with. Right? The only way to do away with white privilege, ultimately, like Tim Wise says, is to do away with whites. So the only way to do away with the increasingly important inherited aspect of intelligence and IQ is to attempt to ameliorate, to do away with genetic differences, to level the playing field by leveling everyone's genes, literally to purposefully hybridize all of humanity into an indistinguishable gray mass of mongrel mutts. They want to level the playing field through dysgenic miscegenation. It's called social engineering through promoting race mixing. It happens all the time. You see it every day, don't you? So counter-eugenically, the controlled media, news and entertainment, and financial incentives through jobs and grants and promotions, and politically through approval and advancement, all these things reward mixed-race mongrel mutts and penalize purebreeds. They penalize non-Michelings. So what about those ultimate egalitarian promoters? What about the Jews? What about those who echo and those who push the miscegenation of our people and all people into goyim, into cattle, consumers and laborers that they can control? Well, it didn't work out for them. They certainly don't support diversity for Israel, do they? And multiculturalism, you know, it doesn't work there. They have a wall. They have a law of return. They have a racially based ethnostate. But they also have, in the diaspora outside of Israel, a growing level of assimilation and race mixing of Jews. Extremely high. It's even considered by Jews to be their greatest threat, that assimilation. So that's right. Not us, but intermarriage. That's what Jews fear the most, because it's wiping them out. They're disappearing. Jews have really succeeded through the cognitive dissonance of strengthening their own group internal loyalty and solidarity while, you know, simultaneously undermining ours, undermining the homogeneity of their host, to make sure they aren't recognized and singled out as the only minorities and pogromed once again for number 110, right? So they push for open borders, the counterculture, for feminism, and for gay rights, and for civil rights. They're all tools the Jews use to weaken their host, that's us, and create heterogeneous, multiracial messes which they can hide in. And they don't really believe in or want it for themselves, or at least they didn't, until they started getting high on their own supply. They started buying their own bullshit message. And that's why memes demanding diversity for Israel, as I led chants calling for outside the Israeli embassy in D.C. like 15 years ago a few times, it really chaps their yarmulkes so much. That's why ads promoting Jewish women and black men together dating really spins their dreidels. Oy vey, it stings. You know, it's almost as much pain for them as the Muslims, which the Jews have pushed into Europe, making Europe more anti-Semitic and then forcing the Jews in Europe to make Aliyah. It stings almost that much. Almost. But like every parasite, because that's what they are. Like every parasite, and to be certain, all Jews are parasites. Eventually the host gets weak and sick and dies, or it crushes the parasite and kills them. And the parasites eventually end up eating their own if they survive. Just ask Harvey Weinstein and Charlie Sheen and Dustin Hoffman and Louis C.K., and they can no longer differentiate food from family. Or you can ask, you know, other Jews, like the rabbis, and the majority of Jews now. This is what worries rabbis so much. The majority of Jews outside of Israel marry outside of their race, over 50%. And outside of the Orthodox communities, that rate is over 71%. Outside of Israel, their birth rate is close to zero. And the assimilation rate of Israelis living in the U.S. is 75%. So within a generation, as the world's aging Jewish population in America and Europe dies off and more younger Jews make Aliyah by moving back to their racist state, the majority of the world's Jews will actually live in Israel. Now, white nationalists, you know, are rightfully concerned about the demographic future of our people. And I was going to make that point to the Channel 13 Israeli TV crew that wanted to come out to interview me yesterday. I didn't want to give them access to our Shilwal Network meeting. I refused that. But I was going to give them 1 hour. They could fly in, have 1 hour of my time. If that was sufficient for them, fine. If not, I had better things to do. That didn't work for them, so I did not bend over backwards any further to meet with them. So I basically told them that, oh well, too bad, so sad. I was going to point out to them that they are going to become extinct a lot quicker than we are, at least in everywhere except Israel. Now, white nationalists, you know, we do have something to worry about. White genocide is real. But the reality is, however, that about the time America balkanizes in a few years and white ethnostates start to arise again, well, that means that, really, they're going to be in a lot worse shape than we are. There'll be far fewer Jews in North America and Europe numerically and by percentage than there ever have been before. And in fact, through natural aging and through low birth rates and assimilation and making Aliyah, there may be almost no Jews remaining in white nations by the end of the 21st century. They'll almost all be living in Israel. Now, of course, there'll be some crypto Jews and there'll be some mixed race Jews, but we'll have to watch out for them. Most likely that will encourage the geographic expansion of the Zionist state into greater Israel, as their Jewish population is projected in the next generation to double from what it is now. So we should still, of course, beware of those mongrelized mixed races and crypto Jews who carry a half or even a quarter of the serpent seed, certainly. But, you know, their power here will be broken. It will have been broken, and along with their self-identity. And that's without us even having to fire up the ovens once again. No, we still can after. But relying for so long on the Jewish diaspora for funding, directly as remittances and reparations and foreign economic and military aid, and indirectly through imputing guilt over the Holocaust and donations from gullible Zionist Christians and the benefits of espionage, Israel is not really set up psychologically, culturally, or politically, or militarily, even to survive as a truly autonomous state. You know, without its big brother, without us to be a bully and fight its wars by proxy for them. And so whether they can or will remains to be seen. You know, either way, it won't be our problem. Once we've converted the Judeo-Christians to Christian identists, the Jews will be on their own. And if the parasite tries to bite us again, Then we can stand back at a distance and turn them all into a glass-paved, glow-in-the-dark parking lot for the Indians with a dot. Now, ultimately, thank you. Don't come again. You know, 110 times was enough, so you can go eat your own. Now, I want to give you just a little bit of insight into what a Shield Wall Network meeting is like. And yesterday's was, as I said at the top of the hour, really surprising in a good way, something that we did not anticipate or expect happened, but I want to share with you how happy we were that it did. Of course, I'm talking about Jacob Goodwin's parents being there, and Jacob himself calling in and through the speaker talking to everybody at our Shield Wall Network meeting. It was wonderful. So this was December the 2nd, which was yesterday, in Central Arkansas at the Shield Wall Network meeting. And, you know, we gave an update on local progress and recruiting new members, and some of them were present, and gaining influence in our local communities through networking. We talked about that as well. And for the year-end summary, for the end of our very first year as a network, as our existence, in that first year, we are now as active as any white nationalist or alt-right organization. And we are larger than many of them in terms of numbers. We continue to grow exponentially at a rate that I hadn't even hoped for. It's really keeping me busy trying to vet new people and bring them in. So we talked about our first year's exploits with the rallies and demonstrations and protests that we took part in and that we actually led ourselves. We briefly recapped everything that's happened over the last 12 months, and we talked about, well, we revealed some of our immediate plans for the near future, and then we also talked about the Shield Wall plan, Project New America, especially for the new people. And we shared that with those who had not yet had an opportunity to become familiar with our overall long-range goal as well. And we talked about the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charities White Family Drive, the results of that so far. After that was discussed, we thanked all the sponsors. Al gave a very informative presentation about prepping, complete with handouts discussing food and water selection, storage, as well as emergency supplies, because originally, and still at our core, the Shield Wall Network is a white nationalist preppers collective. Now, Al's going to present a much more in-depth lecture on the subject of prepping at the next official Shield Wall Network meeting in Northern Arkansas on February the 17th, 2018. And you can read more about his presentation and about prepping at the Shield Wall Network website, the Shield Wall Network website, which is shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com. Or if you can't remember shieldwallnetwork.wordpress.com, you can just type in arianwarrior.com and click on the shield and go to the Shield Wall Network website. Now, after Al spoke, we had intermission and a smoke break. And Scott and Tamara, Jacob Goodwin's parents, gave an impassioned plea for support for their son, the political prisoner now incarcerated in a Charlottesville, Virginia jail awaiting trial. So I encourage you to go to Funded Justice and continue to help out with Jacob's commissary and with his legal defense fund. After we heard the update on Jacob's condition and his treatment and the defense progress, which is really encouraging, he has another meeting with his lawyer this Monday, and then the hearing is December the 14th. It was frustrating, though, to hear in their voices, you know, the dismay at the fact that despite being asked to help, the multimillionaire activist, who I'm not going to call his name, but you know who I'm talking about probably, the multimillionaire activist and alt-right leader and spokesperson who's largely responsible for promoting the Unite the Right rally, he's not yet had an opportunity to contribute financially or otherwise at all to help Jacob or any of the Charlottesville defendants. However, you know, Jacob himself called in to our meeting, was able to speak to his fellow Shield Wall Network members on the speakerphone. You know, despite being in jail 900 miles away, Jacob literally paid to be able to speak to the Phalanx and the other Shield Wall affiliates who also attended the meeting. And especially, you know, in contrast to those affiliates who are much closer and were free and did not attend, that was really very particularly inspiring. So his parents were given $700 in cash raised in donations to help them with their travel expenses to go and visit Jacob for his next scheduled hearing on December the 14th. And those who would like to continue to help support Jacob's Commissary Fund and legal defense may do so through the Funded Justice or the GoFundMe.com site. Jacob was always gracious, and it was really a joy to hear him laughing and joking. He gave an inspiring talk himself, really, to all of us assembled over the phone, and thanked the Showall Network especially for our continued support. He seems to be doing okay. You know, he's received the first two books which were ordered for him and sent to him there in jail, and was able to personally thank the people responsible for sending them in, too. So, you know, we had a lot of delicious homemade snacks and sandwiches and other treats that were enjoyed during the intermission while we were talking to Jacob, but he was talking to us. And then later on, after that call was over, there was a raffle of some collectible White Nationalist Movement memorabilia. We had a Shieldwell Phalanx meeting, which you can find a full report on at the RoperReportSite.wordpress.com and at the Shieldwell Network website, following the regular gathering, which led to some in-real-life local activism after the meeting. So, we always invite interested White Nationalists, especially those in our area, in the Arkansas area, or in any adjoining states, really, to join us for our next regularly scheduled Shieldwell Network meeting in February. And always wish you all a Merry Christmas in the meantime. Now, when we talk about our online activism, when we talk about our in-real-life activism, everything is a means to an end. We're not just engaged in make-work projects to stay busy or to make ourselves feel special or important. We're not just trying to kill time. We are literally reaching out to our people and becoming persons of influence in our community more and more every single day. Whether I'm walking through Walmart and I'm wearing a George Lincoln Rockwell t-shirt and some guy recognizes it and asks me if that's who it is and starts talking to me about listening to InfoWars and I have an opportunity to give him a Showall Network business card, or whether we're distributing them when we go to restaurants and eat out or on bulletin boards, or whether we're literally meeting new people for the very first time at cultural events or online and encouraging them to be willing to stand up and speak up for their people. Whether it's local business owners or laborers, whether it's blue-collar white folks or those who are on the city council and county judges, we're beginning to make massive inroads in our communities as we become persons of influence and ultimately putting the Shieldwell plan into action. Now, over this last week, I've been talking a lot with the leader and organizer of the White Ethnostate Rising in the Upper Northeast, New Albion. And you can read articles about them at newalbion.org. That's newalbion.org. This next week, we'll also be featuring articles about another rising ethnostate with whom we're partnering, and that is the state of Franklin. It's centered in eastern Tennessee, but includes adjoining areas of Appalachia. So, on the Roper Report and the Showall Network websites, and this next week, you'll be able to read about our partnership and parallel cooperation with other rising white ethnostates alongside our region of Ozarkia. So, we want to encourage all of you who are working to create PLEs, Pioneer Little Europes, in your region to contact us. Contact me through Roper_Billy@yahoo.com. There's no reason for us to be enemies or adversaries or to think of ourselves as being competitors. This is not a conflict. We're all working towards the same end. And I am not taking anything away from any other seedbed white ethnostate, and they're not taking anything away from me. And that's true of resources and of population and personnel. We're all working towards the common goal. As America begins to balkanize and break up, there'll be several white ethnostates in different areas around the nation. There could be one near you. If not, we'll help you find the nearest so that you can migrate and vote with your feet so that you'll be on the right side when America balkanizes. So I encourage you, if you're not, to go to Amazon.com and to order the Hasten the Day trilogy by Billy Roper for a fictional account of the coming breakup of America. And for nonfiction, you can read The Balk, B-A-L-K, by the same author. Once again, that's The Balk, B-A-L-K, and the Hasten the Day trilogy by Billy Roper to understand what's coming as America polarizes and divides and gets ready to balkanize. We hope that you've enjoyed our discussion of telogeny and how egalitarianism is eating ourselves, is really
egalitarianism destroys not only us, but egalitarianism destroys the parasites who have been hoisted on their own petard. And their cootie paw is leading them towards extinction faster than it is us. So take the white pill, be encouraged, be uplifted, be courageous, and like Jacob Goodwin, be brave. To end the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast for this week, I want to play for you this interview that I did with Jacob Goodwin's parents yesterday at the Shieldwall Network meeting. And then once it's over, I want you to think about the courage of this young man and, just as importantly, the bravery of his parents who are standing beside him and so richly deserve our support. Until next time, this is Billy Roper for the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, reminding you as always to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white. Hello and welcome back to the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, coming to you live from the Shieldwall Network meeting in Central Arkansas. Today is December the 2nd, 2017, and with me today at the Shieldwall Network meeting are Scott and Tamara Goodwin, the parents of Jacob Goodwin, the political prisoner incarcerated in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the incidents of August the 12th this year. Jacob is now awaiting trial, but I'd like to give his parents an opportunity to give everyone who listens to the Roper Report an update on Jacob's case and the situation. So, Mr. and Mrs. Goodwin, how is Jacob doing, and what are the next steps in his case?
He seems to be in good spirits. Every time we talk to him, he seems to be upbeat, as upbeat as you could expect anyone in his situation. For those of you who don't know, we did lose the fight for extradition. He has been taken back to Charlottesville. On December the 14th, he will have his arraignment trial. Right now, his lawyers are moving forward with his defense strategy. They seem very positive, very hopeful that he has a great case. Every motion that has been filed on behalf of all of the defendants in Charlottesville have been denied so far. It's a very caustic, very bad situation there. It's a hostile environment towards anyone that was involved in the Unite the Right rally. But we hope that the truth will come out and that Jacob will be exonerated, as will the rest of the people that have been arrested in connection with that. He's been receiving a lot of support. We thank everyone out there who's contributed to his defense fund, who has sent commissary, books written. All your support has been great. It's been necessary. It helps us. Every time we hear someone say something good or someone sends a word of support, it does help us. Thanksgiving was a very trying time for us. It was the first time that Jacob has not been at home with his family for Thanksgiving. So that was a pretty rough day. But other than that, we're hopeful that all of this will be over and that Jacob will be found not guilty, and he will be home with his friends and family very soon. There again, we appreciate all the support from everyone out there.
Thank you. Mrs. Goodwin, would you like to say anything to those who have been supporting Jacob with his legal defense fund and through his commissary, and would be sending cards and letters through the address, and those who continue to support the other defendants?
Yes, I don't know how. Thank you's not enough. I don't know how to thank people enough for what has happened. I'm trying not to cry. I'm getting choked up, but He does know that when he gets out, that he's a lot of thank yous to give out. I can't tell y'all the support, and I can't give enough hugs. And to tell y'all, I'm just a mother, and I want my baby to come home, of course. I do support him for what he has done. He's standing up and stronger than most grown men, twice his age. You know, his brother asked him to please just bail out and say, you know, I got caught up in something. He said, Mom, I can't do it. He said, I'm not a coward. I stand up for what I believe. And even the letter he got from a lieutenant commander saying that, you know, standing up and for what's right and not letting some man, older man, get beat to death is the right thing to do, and to giving up his freedom. And those are not just words. Those are words that make my heart swell to hear the good things about my son. And I'm a very proud mother. We're very proud parents, because most boys, 23 years old, he just turned 23 in jail, which I never dreamed would happen. He is strong, and he loves the brotherhood that he's receiving. And I just can't tell you how proud we are, and that he does fight. Most kids, 23, don't even care about what's going on around them except gang banging and doing things wrong. And my son is standing up for something right. And he said, Mom, he wouldn't change it for the world. He knows that he's in there for a reason. And if everybody that can hear my voice, young or old, understand there is a fight. We can't just lay down and let it lie. We have to see and reach more people to grow. Growth is everything, to open people's eyes. I'm one. This has opened my eyes to see what's going on around me. And we meet people every day, Scott and I, that people's eyes are closed. They don't have a clue what's going on around them.
Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Goodwin, for joining us once again on the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, with an update about Jacob Goodwin's condition, the political prisoner being held in Charlottesville, Virginia, after the Unite the Right rally. He has his next hearing December the 14th.
Yes.
And we believe that a trial date will be set then, and we'll continue to keep everyone updated on Jacob Goodwin's case. We urge you to continue to support him through cards and letters and through contributions to his commissary. Yes. To help encourage him and remind him that he is not forgotten. Thank you so much for listening. And this is Billy Roper with the Roper Report, live from the Shieldwall Network Central Arkansas meeting, December the 2nd, 2017.
The student band, I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light, let them think it's all right, cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry, do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're set a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down, get the banks control, cause they are to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
Listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.